right. Denth was a slimmer form in front of her. She remembered his speed, the way he'd slain those bodyguards at the restaurant. Remembered the way they'd destroyed Lemix's house. Remembered their flippancy toward death. They'd hidden it all behind a veil of humor. Now that Denth had brought another lantern, she could see a couple of large sacks stuffed underneath the stairs. A foot was hanging out of one of them. A boot bore the crest of the Idrian army on its side. Her father had sent people to recover her. Denth had just found them before they found her. How many had he killed? Bodies wouldn't keep for long in this basement. Those two corpses must be relatively new, awaiting disposal somewhere else. Why? She asked again, nearly too stunned to speak. You seemed like my friends. We are, Denth said. I like you, princess. He smiled, a genuine smile, not a dangerous leer, like Tonk Fa. If it means anything, I really am sorry. Parlin wasn't supposed to die. That was an accident. But, well, a job is a job. We do what we're paid to do. I explained this all to you several times, I'm sure you recall. I never really believed, she whispered.
They never do,
Tonk Fa said. Vivenna blinked. Get away quickly, while you still have strength. She'd escaped once. Wasn't that enough? Didn't she deserve some peace? Quickly. She twisted her arm, slapping it against the back of Tonk Fa's cloak. Grab! Denth, however, was too fast. He yanked her back, covered her mouth, then snatched her other hand, holding it tightly. Tonk Fa stood surprised as Vivenna's dress bled free of color, turning gray, and some of her breath passed through Denth's fingers and into Tonk Fa's cloak. Yet without a command, that breath couldn't do anything. It had been wasted, and Vivenna felt the world around her grow more dull. Denth released her mouth and slapped Tonk Fa on the back of the head.
Hey,
Tonk Fa said, rubbing his head. Pay attention, Denth said. Then he glanced at Vivenna, holding her arm tightly. Blood seeped between his fingers from her wounded wrist. Denth froze, obviously seeing her bloodied wrists for the first time. The dark cellar had obscured them. He looked up, meeting her eyes.
Ah, hell, he cursed. You didn't run from us, did you?
Huh?
Tonk Fa asked. Vivenna was numb.
What happened?
Denth asked.
Was it him?
She didn't respond. Denth grimaced, then twisted her arm, causing her to yelp.
All right. It looks like my hand has been forced. Let's deal with that breath of yours first. Then we can have a chat. Nicely, like friends, about what has happened to you.
Claude stepped up beside Denth, gray eyes staring forward, empty, as always. Except, could she see something in them? Was she imagining it? Her emotions were so strained lately that she really couldn't trust her perceptions. Claude seemed to meet her eyes.
Now, Denth said, face growing harder, repeat after me. My life to yours, my breath become yours.
Vivenna looked up at him, meeting his eyes. Howl of the sun, she whispered.
Denth frowned. What?
Attack, Denth. Howl of the sun. Denth began. At that moment, Claude's fist hit his face. The blow threw Denth to the side and into Tonk Fa, who cursed and stumbled. Vivenna wrenched free, ducking past Claude, nearly tripping on her dress, and threw her shoulder into the surprised Jules. Jules fell. Vivenna scrambled up the stairs.
"You let her hear the security phrase?"
Denth bellowed, sounds of struggle coming from where he was wrestling with Claude. Jules gained her feet and followed Vivenna. The woman's foot broke through a step, however. Vivenna stumbled into the room above, then threw the door shut. She reached over, turning the latch.
"Won't hold them for long," she thought, feeling helpless. "They'll keep coming, chasing me, just like Vasher. God of colors, what am I going to do?"
She rushed out onto the street, now lit by the dawn light filling the city, and ducked down an alleyway. Then she just kept running, this time trying to pick the smallest, dirtiest, darkest alleyways she could. Chapter 36.
"I will not leave you,"
Sesebron wrote, sitting on the floor beside the bed, his back propped up by pillows.
"I promise."
"How can you be sure?"
Ciri asked from her place on the bed.
"Maybe once you have an heir, you'll grow tired of life, then give away your breath."
"First of all," he wrote, "I'm still not even sure how I would get an heir. You refuse to explain it to me, nor will you answer my questions."
"They're embarrassing," Ciri said, feeling her short hair grow red.
She turned it back to yellow in an instant.
"Secondly," he wrote, "I cannot give away my breath, not if what I understand about biochroma is true. Do you think I've been lied to about how breath works?"
He's getting much more articulate in his writing, Ciri thought, as she watched him erase. It's such a shame that he's been locked up his entire life.
"I really don't know that much about it," she said. "Biochroma isn't exactly something we focus on in Idris. I suspect that half of the things I know are rumors and exaggerations. For instance, back in Idris, they think you sacrifice people on altars in the court here. I heard that a dozen times from different people."
He paused, then continued writing.
"Regardless, we argue something that is absurd. I will not change. I am not going to suddenly decide to kill myself. You do not need to worry."
She sighed.
"Ciri," he wrote, "I lived for 50 years with no information, no knowledge, barely able to communicate. Can you really think that I would kill myself now? Now, when I've discovered how to write, when I've discovered someone to talk to, when I've discovered you."
She smiled. "All right, I believe you. But I still think we have to worry about your priests." He didn't respond, looking away.
"Why is he so cursedly loyal to them?" she thought.
Finally, he looked back at her.
"Would you grow your hair?"
She raised an eyebrow.
"And what color am I to make it?"
"Red," he wrote.
"You Halandrin and your bright colors," she said, shaking her head. "Do you realize that my people considered red the most flagrant of all colors?"
He paused.
"I'm sorry," he wrote. "I did not mean to offend you. I..."
He broke off as she reached down and touched his arm.
"No," she said. "Look, I wasn't arguing. I was just being flirtatious. I'm sorry."
"Flirtatious?" he wrote. "My storybook doesn't use this term."
"I know," Ciri said. "That book is too full of stories about children getting eaten by trees and things."
"The stories are metaphors meant to teach."
"Yes, I know," she said, interrupting him again.
"So, what is flirtatious?"
"It's colors. How do I get myself into these situations? She thought. It's when a girl acts hesitant, or sometimes silly, in order to make a man pay more attention to her.
Why would that make a man pay attention to her?
Well, like this. She looked at him, leaning forward a bit. Do you want me to grow my hair?
Yes. Do you really want me to? Of course.
Well then, if I must, she said, tossing her head and commanding her hair become a deep auburn red. It flushed mid-toss, flaring from yellow to red like ink bleeding into a pool of clear water. Then she made it grow. The ability was more instinctive than conscious, like flexing a muscle. In this case, it was a muscle she'd been using a lot lately, since she tended to cut her hair off in the evenings rather than spending the time combing it. Even as the hair whipped past her face, it grew in length. She tossed her head one final time, the hair making it feel more heavy, her neck warm from the locks that now tumbled down around her shoulders and down her back, twisting in loose curls. Sesebron looked at her with wide eyes. She met them, then tried a seductive glance. The result seemed so ridiculous to her, however, that she just found herself laughing. She fell back on the bed, newly grown hair flaring around her. Sesebron tapped her leg. She looked over at him, and he stood up, sitting on the side of the bed so that she could see his tablet as he wrote.
You are very strange, he said.
She smiled. I know. I'm not meant to be a seductress. I can't keep a straight face.
Seductress, he wrote. I know that word. It is used in a story when the evil queen tries to tempt the young prince with something, though I don't know what.
She smiled.
I think she must have been planning to offer him food.
Yeah, Ciri said. Good interpretation there, Seb. Completely right. He hesitated.
She wasn't offering food, was she?
Ciri smiled again. He flushed.
I feel like such an idiot. There is so much that everyone else understands intrinsically, yet I have only the stories of a children's book to guide me. I've read them so often that it's hard to separate myself and the way I view them from the child I was when I first read them.
He began to erase furiously. She sat up, then laid a hand on his arm.
I know that there are things I'm missing, he wrote, things that embarrass you. And I have guesses. I am not a fool, and yet I get frustrated. With your flirtation and sarcasm, both behaviors where you apparently act opposite to what you want, I fear that I will never understand you.
He stared with frustration at his board, wiping cloth held in one hand, charcoal in the other. The fire cracked quietly in the fireplace, throwing waves of overbright yellow against his clean-shaven face. I'm sorry, she said, scooting closer to him. She wrapped her arms around his elbow, laying her head against his upper arm. He actually didn't seem that much bigger than she, now that she was used to it. There had been men back in Idris who had stood as much as 6.5 feet tall, and Sesebron was only a few inches taller than that. Plus, because his body was so perfectly proportioned, he didn't seem spindly or unnatural. He was normal, just bigger. He glanced at her as she rested her head on his arm and closed her eyes. I think you are doing better than you think. Most people back in my homeland didn't understand me half as well as you do. He began to write, and she opened her eyes.
I find that hard to believe.
It's true, she said.
They kept telling me to become someone else.
Who?
My sister, she said with a sigh. The woman you were supposed to marry. She was everything the daughter of a king should be. Controlled, soft-spoken, obedient, learned.
She sounds boring, he wrote, smiling.
Vivenna is a wonderful person, Ciri said. She was always very kind to me. It's just that, well, I think even she felt that I should have been more reserved.
I can't understand that, he wrote. You're wonderful. So full of life and excitement. The priests and servants of the palace, they wear colors, but there's no color inside of them. They just go about their duties, eyes down, solemn. You've got color on the inside, so much of it that it bursts out and colors everything around you.
She smiled. That sounds like biochroma.
You are more honest than biochroma, he wrote. My breath, it makes things more bright, but it isn't mine. It was given to me. Yours is your own.
She felt her hair shift from the deep red into a golden tone, and she sighed softly with contentment, pulling herself a little closer to him.
How do you do that?
He wrote. Do what?
Change your hair.
That one was unconscious, she said. It goes blonde if I feel happy or content.
You're happy, then? He wrote. With me?
Of course.
But when you speak of the mountains, there is such longing in your voice.
I miss them, she said. But if I left here, I'd miss you, too. Sometimes you can't have everything you want, since the wants contradict each other. They fell silent for a time, and he set aside his board, hesitantly wrapping his arm around her and leaning back against the headboard. A blushful tinge of red crept into her hair as she realized that they were still sitting on the bed, and she was snuggling up beside him, wearing only her shift.
But, well, she thought, we are married, after all.
The only thing that spoiled the moment was the occasional rumbling of her stomach. After a few minutes, Sisebron reached for his board.
You are hungry? He wrote.
No, she said. My stomach is an anarchist. It likes to growl when it's full. He paused.
Sarcasm?
A poor attempt, she said. It's all right. I'll survive.
Didn't you eat before you came to my chambers?
I did, she said. But growing that much hair is draining. It always leaves me hungry.
It makes you hungry every night?
He asked, writing quickly.
And you didn't say anything?
She shrugged.
I will get you food.
No, we can't afford to expose ourselves.
Expose what?
He wrote.
I am God King. I have food whenever I wish it. I have sent for it at night before. This will not be odd.
He stood, walking toward the doorway. Wait, she said. He turned, glancing back at her.
You can't go to the door like that, Sisebron, she said, keeping her voice quiet in case someone was listening. You're still fully dressed.
He looked down, then frowned.
Make your clothing look disheveled at least, she said, quickly hiding his writing board.
He undid his neck buttons, then threw off his deep black overrobe, revealing an undergown. Like everything white near him, it gave off a halo of rainbow colors. He reached up, mussing his dark hair. He turned back to her, eyes questioning. Good enough, she said. pulling the bedsheets up to her neck, covering herself. She watched curiously as Susebron rapped on the door with his knuckles. It immediately opened.
He's too important to open his own door, Ciri thought.
He commanded food by putting a hand to his stomach, then pointing away. The servants, barely visible to Ciri through the doorway, scuttled away at his order. He turned as the door closed, walking back to sit beside her on the bed. A few minutes later, servants arrived at the room with a dining table and a chair. They set the table with large amounts of food, everything from roasted fish to pickled vegetables and simmering shellfish. Ciri watched with amazement. There's no way they fixed it that quickly. They simply had it waiting in the kitchens, should their god happen to grow hungry. It was wasteful to the point of extravagance, but it was also wondrous. It bespoke a lifestyle that her people back in Idris couldn't even imagine. One representative of an uncomfortable imbalance in the world. Some people starved. Others were so wealthy that they never even saw most meals that were made for them. The servants set only one chair at the table. Ciri watched as they brought in plate after plate. They couldn't know what the God King wanted, so they apparently brought him some of everything. They filled the table, then retreated as Susebron pointed for them to go. The scents were almost too much for Ciri in her hungered state. She waited, tense, until the door closed. Then she threw off the sheets and rushed over. She had thought the meals prepared for her were extravagant, but they were nothing compared to this feast. Susebron gestured toward the chair. "Aren't you going to eat?" she asked. He shrugged. She walked over and took one of the blankets from the bed, then spread it on the stone floor. "What looks good to you?" she said, approaching the table. He pointed at the plate of simmering mussels and several of the breads. She moved these, along with a dish that didn't appear to have any fish in it, a bowl of exotic fruits tossed in some kind of creamy sauce, to the cloth. She then sat down and began eating. Susebron carefully situated himself on the floor. He managed to look dignified, even when wearing only his undergown. Ciri reached over and handed him his board.
"This is very odd," he said.
"What?" she asked. "Eating on the floor?" He nodded.
"Dining is such a production for me.
I eat some of what is on a plate, then servants pull it away, wipe my face, and bring me another one. I never finish an entire dish, even if I like it."
Ciri snorted. "I'm surprised they don't hold the spoon for you."
"They did when I was younger,"
Susebron wrote, flushing.
"I eventually got them to let me do it myself. It's hard when you can't speak with anyone."
"I can imagine," Ciri said between mouthfuls. She eyed Susebron, who ate with small, reserved bites. She felt a slight stab of shame at how fast she was eating, then decided she didn't care. She put aside the fruit dish and fetched several pastries from the table. Susebron eyed her as she began to eat one after another.
"Those are Pankal Tinkfans," he wrote. "One takes only small bites, making sure to eat a piece of bread between to clear away the taste. They are a delicacy, and..."
He broke off as Ciri picked up an entire pastry and shoved it into her mouth. She smiled at him, then continued chewing. After a moment of looking stunned, he wrote on his board again,
"You realize that children in the stories who gorged themselves usually ended up being thrown off of cliffs."
Ciri stuffed another crisp bread into her mouth beside the first, dusting her fingers and face with powdered sugar in the process, her cheeks bulging. Susebron watched her. then reached over and took a whole one himself. He inspected it, then shoved it into his mouth. Siri laughed, nearly spitting out bits of pastry onto the blanket. "And so my corruption of the God-King continues," she said, once she could speak. He smiled.
"This is very curious," he wrote, eating another crisp bread,
then another, then another. Siri watched him, raising an eyebrow. "One would think that as God-King, you would at least be able to eat sweets whenever you want."
"I have many rules that others need not follow," he wrote as he chewed. "The stories explained this. Much is required of a prince or a king. I would rather have been born a peasant."
Siri raised an eyebrow. She had a feeling that he'd be surprised if he actually had to experience things like hunger, poverty, or even discomfort. However, she left him his illusions. Who was she to chastise?
"You are the one who was hungry," he wrote, "but I am the one doing all the eating."
"They obviously don't feed you enough," Siri said, trying a slice of bread. He shrugged, continuing to eat. She watched him, wondering if eating was different for him, with no tongue. Did that affect his ability to taste? He certainly still seemed to like the sweets. Thinking of her tongue made her mind turn to darker topics. "We can't just keep going on like this," she thought, "playing around at night, pretending like the world isn't going on without us. We're going to get crushed."
"Sesebron," she said, "I think we need to find a way to expose what your priests have been doing to you."
He looked up, then wrote,
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that we should have you try to talk to the common people," she said, "or maybe some of the other gods. The priests gain all of their power by associating with you. If you choose to communicate through someone else, it would overthrow them."
"Do we need to do that?"
"Pretend with me for a moment that we do," she said.
"Very well," he wrote, "but how, exactly, would I communicate with someone else? I can't exactly stand up and begin shouting."
"I don't know. Notes, perhaps?" He smiled.
"There is a story about that in my book. A princess trapped in a tower who throws notes out into the ocean waters. The king of the fishes finds them."
"I doubt the king of the fishes cares about our predicament," Siri said flatly.
"Such a creature is only slightly less fantastic than the possibility of my notes being found and interpreted correctly. If I threw them out the window, nobody would believe that the God-King had written them."
"And if you passed them to servants?" He frowned.
"Assuming that you are right, and that my priests are working against me, then wouldn't it be foolhardy to trust the servants they employ?"
"Perhaps. We could try a Pon-Call servant."
"None of them attend me, for I am the God-King," he wrote. "Besides, what if we did get a servant or two on our side? How would that expose the priests? Nobody would believe a Pon-Call servant who contradicted the priests."
She shook her head. "I suppose you could try making a scene, running away or causing a distraction."
"When outside of the palace, I am constantly attended by a troop of hundreds. Awakeners, soldiers, guards, priests, and lifeless warriors. Do you honestly think I could make any kind of a scene without being rushed away before I could communicate with anyone?"
"No," she admitted. "But we have to do something. There has to be a way out of this.
I do not see one. We need to work with the priests, not against them. Perhaps they know more about why the god kings die. They could tell us. I can speak to them, using the artisan's script.
No, Ciri said. Not yet. Let me think first.
Very well,
he wrote, then tried another pastry. Sesebron, she finally said. Would you consider running away with me? Back to Idris? He frowned.
Perhaps, he finally wrote. That seems extreme.
What if I could prove that the priests are trying to kill you? And what if I could provide a way out? Someone to smuggle us from the palace and out of the city? The concept obviously bothered him.
If it is the only way, he wrote, then I will go with you. But I do not believe that we will get to that point.
I hope you're right, she said. But if you're not, she thought, then we're escaping. We'll take our chances back with my family. War or no war. Chapter 37. In the slums, it could seem like night, even during the full light of day. Vivenna wandered, aimless, stepping over soiled bits of colorful trash. She knew that she should find a place to hide and stay there, yet she wasn't really thinking straight anymore. Parlin was dead. He'd been her friend since childhood. She'd convinced him to come with her on what now seemed the most idiotic of quests. His death was her fault. Denth and his team had betrayed her. No, they had never worked for her. Now that she looked back, she could see the signs. How conveniently they'd found her in the restaurant. How they'd used her to get at Lemix's breath. How they'd manipulated her, letting her feel that she was in control. They'd just been playing along. She'd been a prisoner and never known it. The betrayal felt so much the worse for how she'd come to trust, even befriend them. She should have seen the warnings. Tonk Fa's joking brutality. Dent's explanations that mercenaries had no allegiances. He'd pointed out that Jules would work against her own gods. Compared with that, what was betraying a friend? She stumbled down yet another alleyway, hand on the wall of a brick building beside her. Dirt and soot stained her fingers. Her hair was a bleached white. It still hadn't recovered. The attack in the slum had been frightening. Getting captured by Vasher had been terrifying. But seeing Parlin tied to that chair, blood coming from his nose, his cheeks sliced open to reveal the inside of his mouth. She would never forget. Something inside of her seemed broken. Her ability to care. She was just numb. She reached the end of the alleyway, then looked up dully. There was a wall in front of her, a dead end. She turned to go back.
You,
a voice said. Vivenna turned, surprised at the speed of her own reaction. Her mind remained shocked, but a carnal part of her was still awake, capable of defensive instinct. She stood in a narrow alley like those she had walked down all day. She'd kept to the slums, figuring that Denth would expect her to run for the open city. He knew it better than she did. In her addled mind, staying in the cluttered, quiet slum seemed a much better idea. A man sat on a small stack of boxes behind her, legs swinging over the sides. He was short, dark-haired, and wore typical slum clothing, a mixture of garments going through various stages of wear.
You've been causing quite a stir, the man said.
She stood quietly.
Woman wandering the slums in a beautiful white dress, eyes dark, hair white and ragged. If anyone hadn't been so paranoid following the raid the other day, you'd have been seen 2 hours ago.
The man seemed faintly familiar.
You're Itrian, she whispered. You were there, in the crowd, when I visited the slumlords.
He shrugged.
That means you know who I am, she said.
I don't know anything, he said. Particularly not things that could get me into trouble.
Please, she said. You have to help me.
She took a step forward. He hopped off his boxes, a knife flashing in his hand.
Help you?
He asked.
I saw that look in your eyes when you came to the meeting. You looked down on us, just like the Halandrin.
She shied back.
A lot of people have seen you wandering about like a wraith, he said, but nobody seems to know exactly where to find you. There's quite a search going in some parts.
Denth, she thought. It's a miracle I've stayed free so long. I need to do something. Stop wandering. Find a place to hide.
I figure that someone will find you eventually, the man said. So I'm going to act first.
Please, she whispered.
He raised the knife.
I won't turn you in. You deserve at least that much. Besides, I don't want to draw attention to myself. That dress, though, that will sell for a lot, even damaged like it is. I could feed my family for weeks on that cloth.
She hesitated.
Scream, and I'll cut you, he said quietly. It's not a threat. It's just an inevitability. The dress, princess. You'll be better without it. It's what's making everyone take notice of you.
She considered using her breath. But what if it didn't work? She couldn't concentrate and had a feeling that she wouldn't be able to get the commands to work. She wavered, but the looming knife convinced her. So, staring straight ahead and feeling like she was someone else, she reached up and began undoing the buttons.
Don't drop it to the ground, the man said. It's dirty enough already.
She pulled it off, then shivered, standing only in her underleggings and her shift. He took the dress, then opened her pocket pouch. He frowned as he tossed aside the rope inside of it.
No money?
She shook her head dully.
The leggings. They're silk, right?
Her shift came down to her mid-thighs. She stooped down, pulling off the leggings, then handed them over. He took them, and she saw a glint of greed, or perhaps something else, in his eyes.
The shift,
he said, waving his knife.
No,
she said quietly. He took a step forward. Something snapped inside of her.
No, she yelled. No, no, no! You take your city, your colors and clothing, and go! Leave me!
She fell to her knees, crying, and grabbed handfuls of refuse and mud, rubbing it on the shift.
There! She screamed. You want it? Take it from me! Sell it like this!
Contrary to his threats, the man wavered. He looked around, then clutched the valuable cloth to his chest and dashed away. Vivenna knelt. Where had she found more tears? She curled up, heedless of the trash and mud, and wept. It started raining sometime while she was curled in the mud. It was one of the soft, hazy Halandrin rainfalls. The wet drops kissed her cheek. Little streams ran down the sides of the alleyway walls. She was hungry and exhausted. But with the falling rain came a shred of lucidity. She needed to move. The thief had been right. The dress had been a hindrance. She felt naked in the shift, particularly now that it was wet. But she had seen women in the slums wearing just as little. She needed to go on, become just another waif in the dirt and grime. She crawled over to a refuse pile, noticing a bit of cloth sticking from it. She pulled free a muddy, stinking shawl. Or maybe it had been a rug. Either way, she wrapped it around her shoulders, pulling it tight across her chest to offer some measure of modesty. She tried to make her hair black, but it refused. She sat down, too apathetic to be frustrated. Instead, she simply rubbed mud and dirt into her hair, changing the pale white into a sickly brown.
It's still too long, she thought. I'll need to do something about that. It stands out. No beggar would keep hair that long. It would be difficult to care for.
She began to make her way out of the alleyway, then paused. The shawl had become brighter now that she was wearing it.
Breath. I'll be immediately visible to anyone with the first heightening. I can't hide in the slums.
She still felt the loss of the breath she'd sent into the rope, and then the larger amount she'd wasted on Tonk's cloak. Yet she had the greater portion left. She huddled down by the side of the wall, nearly losing control again as she considered the situation. And then she realized something. Tonk Fa snuck up on me down in that cellar. I couldn't feel his breath. Just like I couldn't feel Vasher's when he ambushed me in my rooms. The answer felt so easy, it was ridiculous. She couldn't feel the breath in the rope she'd made. She picked it up, tying it around her ankle. Then she took the shawl, holding it in front of her. It was such a pathetic thing, frayed at the edges, its original red color barely peeking through the grime.
My life to yours, she said, speaking the words Denth had tried to get her to say. My breath become yours.
They were the same words Lemix had spoken when he'd given her his breath. It worked on the shawl, too. Her breath drained from her body, all of it, invested into the shawl. It was no command. The shawl wouldn't be able to do anything. But her breath, hopefully, would be safe. She wouldn't give off an aura. None at all. She almost fell to the ground with the shock of losing it all. Where she had once been able to sense the city around her, now everything became still. It was as if it had been silenced, the entire city becoming dead. Or maybe it was Vivenna who had become dead. A drab. She stood slowly, shivering in the drizzling rain, and wiped the water from her eyes. Then she pulled the shawl, breaths and all, close, and shuffled away.
Chapter 38. Lightsong sat on the edge of his bed, sweat thick on his brow as he stared down at the floor in front of him. He was breathing heavily. Larimar eyed a lesser scribe who lowered his pen. Servants clustered around the edges of the bedchamber. They had, at his request, woken him up unusually early in the morning.
Your Grace?
Larimar asked.
It's nothing, Lightsong thought. I dream of war because I'm thinking about it. Not because of prophecy. Not because I'm a god.
It felt so real. In the dream, he had been a man, on the battlefield, with no weapon. Soldiers had died around him, friend after friend. He had known them, each one close to him.
A war against Idris wouldn't be like that, he thought. It would be fought by our lifeless.
He didn't want to acknowledge that his friends during the dream hadn't been wearing bright colors. He hadn't been seeing through the eyes of a Halandrin soldier, but an Idrian. Perhaps that was why it had been such a slaughter.
The Idrians are the ones threatening us. They're the rebels who broke off, maintaining a second throne inside of Halandrin borders. They need to be quelled. They deserve it.
What did you see, Your Grace?
Larimar asked again. Lightsong closed his eyes. There were other images, the recurring ones, the glowing red panther, the tempest, a young woman's face being absorbed by darkness, eaten alive.
I saw Blushweaver,
he said, speaking only of the very last part of the dreams.
Her face red and flushed. I saw you, and you were sleeping.
And I saw the God King.
The God King?
Larimar asked, sounding excited. Lightsong nodded.
He was crying.
The scribe wrote the images down. Larimar, for once, didn't prompt further. Lightsong stood, forcing the images out of his mind, yet he couldn't ignore that his body felt weak. It was his feast day, and he would have to take in a breath, or he would die.
I'm going to need some urns, Lightsong said. 2 dozen of them, one for each of the gods, painted after their colors.
Larimar gave the order without even asking why.
I'll also need some pebbles,
Lightsong said, as the servants dressed him. Lots of them.
Larimar nodded.
Once Lightsong was dressed, he turned to leave the room. Off once again to feed on the soul of a child. Lightsong threw a pebble into one of the urns in front of him. It made a slight ringing sound.
Well done, Your Grace,
Larimar complimented him, standing beside Lightsong's chair.
Nothing to it,
Lightsong said, tossing another pebble. It fell short of the intended urn, and a servant rushed forward, plucking it off the ground and depositing it in the proper container.
I appear to be a natural, Lightsong noted. I get it in every time.
He felt much better, having been given fresh breath.
Indeed, Your Grace, Larimar said. I believe that Her Grace, the goddess Blushweaver, is approaching.
Good, Lightsong said, throwing another pebble. He hit the target this time. Of course, the urns were only a few feet from his seat.
I can show off my pebble-throwing skills.
He sat on the green of the courtyard, a cool breeze blowing, his pavilion set up just inside the court's gates. He could see the blocking wall, the one that kept him from looking out at the city proper. With the wall in the way, it was a rather depressing sight.
If they're going to lock us in here, he thought, they could at least give us the courtesy of a decent view out.
What in the name of the iridescent tones are you doing?
Lightsong didn't need to look to know that Blushweaver was standing with hands on hips beside him. He threw another pebble.
You know, he said, it's always struck me as strange. When we say oaths like that, we use the colors. Why not use our own names? We are, allegedly, gods.
Most gods don't like their names being used as an oath,
Blushweaver said, sitting beside him.
Then they are far too pompous for my taste,
Lightsong said, tossing a pebble. It missed, and a servant deposited it.
I, personally, should find it very flattering to have my name used as an oath. Lightsong the Brave, or By Lightsong the Bold.
I suppose that's a bit of a mouthful.
Perhaps we could shorten it to a simple Lightsong.
I swear, she said, you are getting stranger by the day.
No, actually, he said. You didn't swear in that particular statement, unless you're proposing we should swear using the personal pronoun. You! So your line at this point is, what in the name of you are you doing?
She grumbled at him under her breath. He eyed her.
I certainly don't deserve that yet. I've barely gotten started. Something else must be bothering you.
All, Mother, she said.
Still won't give you the commands?
Refuses to even speak with me now.
Lightsong threw a pebble into one of the urns.
Ah,
If only she knew the refreshing sense of frustration she was missing out on knowing by refusing your acquaintance.
I'm not that frustrating, Blushweaver said. I've actually been rather charming with her.
Then that is your problem, I surmise, Lightsong said. We're gods, my dear, and we quickly grow tired of our immortal existences. Surely we seek for extreme ranges in emotion. Good or bad, it doesn't matter. In a way, it's the absolute value of emotion that is important, rather than the positive or negative nature of that emotion.
Blushweaver paused. So did Lightsong. Lightsong, dear, she said, what in the name of you did that mean?
I'm not exactly sure, he said. It just kind of came out. I can visualize what it means in my head, though, with numbers.
Are you all right?
She asked, sounding genuinely concerned. Images of warfare flashed in his mind. His best friend, a man he didn't know, dying with a sword through the chest. I'm not sure, he said. Things have been rather strange for me lately. She sat quietly for a moment.
You want to go back to my palace and frolic? That always makes me feel better.
He tossed a pebble, smiling. You, my dear, are incorrigible.
I'm the goddess of lust, for your sake, she said. I've got to fill the role.
Last I checked, he said, you were goddess of honesty.
Honesty and honest emotions, my dear, she said sweetly. And let me tell you, lust is one of the most honest of all emotions. Now, what are you doing with those silly pebbles?
Counting, he said.
Counting your inanities?
That, Lightsong said, tossing another pebble, and counting the number of priests who come through the gates wearing the colors of each god or goddess. Blushweaver frowned. It was midday, and the gates were fairly busy with the comings and goings of servants and performers. There were only occasionally priests or priestesses, however, since they would have been required to come in early to attend their gods. Each time a priest of a particular god enters, Lightsong said, I toss a pebble into the urn representing that god. Blushweaver watched him toss and miss with another pebble. As he'd instructed, the servants picked up the pebble and put it in the proper urn, violet and silver. To the side, one of Hopefinder's priestesses rushed across the green toward her god's palace.
I'm baffled, Blushweaver finally said.
It's easy, Lightsong said. You see someone wearing purple, you throw a pebble in the urn of the same color.
Yes, dear, she said. But why?
To keep track of how many priests of each god enter the court, of course, Lightsong said. They've slowed to nearly a trickle. Scoot, would you mind counting? Larimar bowed and then gathered several servants and scribes, ordering them to empty the urns and count the contents of each one.
My dear Lightsong, Blushweaver said, I do apologize if I've been ignoring you lately. Allmother has been rudely unresponsive to my suggestions. If my lack of attention has caused your fragile mind to snap...
My mind is quite unsnapped, thank you, Lightsong said, sitting up, watching the servants count.
Then you must be so very bored, Blushweaver continued. Perhaps we can come up with something to entertain you.
I'm well entertained. He smiled even before the counting results were in. Mercy Star had one of the smallest piles.
Lightsong?
Blushweaver asked. Nearly all of her playful attitude was gone. I ordered my priests in early today, Lightsong said, glancing at her, and to set up position here, in front of the gates, before the sun even rose. We've been counting priests for some 6 hours now. Larimar walked over, handing Lightsong a list of the gods and the number of priests who had entered, wearing their colors.
Lightsong scanned it, nodding to himself. Some of the gods have had over 100 priests report for service, yet a couple of them have had barely a dozen. Mercy Star is one of those.
So?
Blushweaver asked. So? Lightsong said. I'm going to send my servants to watch and count at Mercy Star's palace, keeping track of the number of priests who are there. I already suspect that I know what they'll find. Mercy Star doesn't have fewer priests than the rest of us. They're just getting into the court by a different route.
Blushweaver looked at him blankly, but then cocked her head. The tunnels?
Lightsong nodded. Blushweaver leaned back, sighing.
Well, at least you're not insane or bored. You're just obsessed.
Something's going on with those tunnels, Blushweaver, and it relates to the servant who was murdered.
Lightsong, we have much bigger problems to worry about.
Blushweaver shook her head, holding her forehead as if she could have a headache.
I can't believe that you're still bothering with this. Honestly, the kingdom is about to go to war. For the first time, your position in the assembly is important, and you're worrying about how priests are getting into the court?
Lightsong didn't respond immediately. Here, he finally said. Let me prove my point to you. He reached over to the side of his couch and picked a small box up off the ground. He held it up, showing it to Blushweaver.
A box, she said flatly. What a convincing argument you make.
He pulled the top off of the box, leaving a small gray squirrel sitting in his hand. It stood perfectly still, staring forward, fur blowing in the breeze.
A lifeless rodent, Blushweaver said. That's much better. I feel myself being swayed already.
The person who broke into Mercy Star's palace used this as a distraction, Lightsong said. Do you know anything about breaking lifeless, my dear? She shrugged. I didn't either, Lightsong said. Not until I required my priests to break this one. Apparently, it requires weeks to take control of a lifeless for which you don't have the right security phrases. I'm not even sure how the process goes. Has something to do with breath and torture, apparently.
Torture? She said. Lifeless can't feel.
Lightsong shrugged. Anyway, my servants broke this one for me. The stronger and more skilled the Awakener who created the lifeless, the more difficult it is to break it.
That's why we need to get the commands from Allmother, Blushweaver said. If something were to happen to her, her 10,000 would become useless to us. It would take years to break that many lifeless.
The God King and some of Allmother's priestesses have the codes as well, Lightsong said.
Oh,
Blushweaver said. And you think he is going to just give them over to us, assuming we're even allowed to talk to him? I'm just pointing out that a single assassination couldn't ruin our entire army, Lightsong said, holding up the squirrel. That's not the point. The point is that whoever made this squirrel held quite a bit of breath and knew what he was doing. The creature's blood has been replaced with ichor alcohol. The sutures are perfect. The commands controlling the rodent were extremely strong. It's a marvelous piece of biochromatic art.
And?
She asked. And he released it in Mercy Star's palace, Lightsong said, creating a distraction so that he could sneak into those tunnels. Someone else followed the intruder, and this second person killed a man to keep him from revealing what he'd seen. Whatever is in those tunnels, wherever they lead, it's important enough to waste breath on. Important enough to kill for.
Blushweaver shook her head. I still can't believe you're even worrying about this.
You said you knew about the tunnels, Lightsong said. I had Larimar ask around, and others know of them too. They're used for storage beneath the palaces, as said. Different gods have ordered them constructed at various times during the history of the court. But, he continued, excited, they would also be the perfect place to set up a clandestine operation.
The court is outside the jurisdiction of the regular city guards. Each palace is like a little autonomous country. Expand a few of those cellars so that their tunnels connect with others. Dig them out past the walls so that you can come and go secretly.